This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 371 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Linda B. And also remind you that there are still spots left on our Pod Abroad 2021 trip. You can find out all about that, the cost, the time, the places, the itinerary, all of that at podabroad.com. And we would still love to have you join our text community. And if you haven't joined, why haven't you? Send us a text at 916-659-5112. It is free to join. There may be your carrier may have rates. We have no control over that, but the service is free. This episode is sponsored by HelloFresh. So before we go on and get to our chapters, Summer and I have been prepping and coming on, and we're getting ready to sign on and record and all that. And she's like, okay, I'll be there just in a minute. So I'm sitting here waiting. And I text her like, is everything okay? Is your Wi-Fi up? She's like, yeah, logging on now. So we get on. And just before I hit record, she's like, well, this is what happened. And I was like, wait a second.
I was like, you might want to hit record on this because it's dumb. So it's so dumb.
It's something I would totally do.
It's dumb. Okay, but it is dumb. I recognize that it's dumb. So I was just finishing up the chapters because there were a lot of them this week. And I had got sucked into my For You page on TikTok, which, to be fair, I don't really post anything on TikTok, but I really like watching TikToks, which is, I'm kind of, you know, like silent observer of the TikTok, whatever. And there was a recipe for lasagna soup. I don't think I've ever desired lasagna soup at all, but I saw it this morning and I've already been to the store today and I'm like, I'm not going again.
You didn't ask me.
Are you going to the store?
No, it's too late. You already went. What are you talking about?
I didn't go to the store. I signed up to Instacart. I got on my Instacart and I was like, I'm going to purchase all the items.
Okay, but you literally said, I already went to the store today. I thought you literally went out. But you just mean you've already shopped today.
No, I've already been to the store. Like, I went to the store on the way home from my 4.6-mile walk that was way longer than I anticipated. So I grabbed a couple of things because I had needed to get some soap, some face wash for my kid. And I was like, I don't really want to go to the store again. And I was like, I'll just instant cart just the items I need for lasagna soup. And I went down a rabbit hole. One, because I had to find the recipe because I had lost that spot. So I was trying to find, and I don't even remember the person whose recipe I was watching that was so intriguing. I was like, I don't even care at this point. All of the recipes are vaguely the same. So I went down a TikTok rabbit hole and I had to finish ordering my instant cart delivery so that I can make lasagna soup. It's not very interesting, but that's exactly why I was late. It's not fun. It's not awesome, but it's what I was doing. I mean, I think it's sexy because cooking is sexy because, you know, I would love people to cook for me. I cook for me all the time.
Well, you're doing the next best thing. You're getting meals that have little to no prep, except their cooking part. So Summer and I are both on, and the podcasts are on TikTok, in case you want to follow us there. We mostly right now, well, at least for the podcast, we mostly just post an image from our new, if I remember, an image from our new episodes. And you can't really link there yet. You can't link. But anyway, we are there, and we both kind of fell into TikTok. So what are we talking about today?
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along. We're going to begin with Chapter 45, entitled A Taint in the Blood.
So when I first wrote this, I didn't write the chapter. When I wrote my notes.
She did not write this.
I did not. I, of course, I did the little giggle like, taint. And so I spelled it the way it should be spelled if you're spelling it that way, which I know probably people don't take the time to do.
How taint else would you spell it?
Taint in the way it should be reflected.
With a T and an apostrophe or what?
Correct. T. Okay. Actually, wait. If you want to be really technical, it would be apostrophe T because it's it, right? The word, it's the word it.
It isn't.
Yes. Well, no, it ain't. So I was wrong. I should have put apostrophe T apostrophe, but I didn't. I put T apostrophe. So I put T apostrophe A-I-N apostrophe T. So whatever. But it's pronounced the same way. A taint in the blood. There is a taint. No, there isn't a taint involved. Oh, I mean, there may have been a taint involved. Just off book. It's funny, though, that that word is on this chapter. So yeah, this chapter, taint in the blood, something like that. We have a date. Remember, whether it's a letter. Whether it's a letter or a publication or an article someplace or not. I probably go overboard, but I think it's important because we get so... Diana's pretty good about it, but we get so little in the shows that I really feel like we need to kind of have these key, these markers every so often to remember when we are. We know we're in the 18th century. We know this. We know where we at. We know where we at. We know where we're at.
Are you talking like that because of the word taint?
No, stop.
Are you sure?
Positive.
Was there an apostrophe in what you just said?
No. I mean, I think yes. We're in June 1774. So we're in first person. So we know it's Claire. And Claire is working in her garden. Yeah. She is reaching for a hoe, literally, to take down the mint and is confronted by a face. It's Manfred McGillivray, who had come earlier with some of the muskets deliver some of the muskets to Jamie.
This right here sets off some that becomes the drama of the next three chapters.
Yeah. So he wants to see Manfred at this moment came to see Claire out in the garden about some doctor stuff. He said he's come most recently from Hillsborough. And what was he doing there? Oh, he was visiting his hoe. Like literally.
I was going to say boffing a chick. Boffin a disease.
No, he wasn't boffin her. He says he can't marry Lizzie because he's in love. He's in love with his hoe. They have boffed, but he didn't boff this last trip.
That doesn't make it okay.
We'll get there. So he's in love with his hoe. Now, Summer will appreciate this. I did look, but there wasn't anything. So same end effect. You don't have to listen to me talk about any symbolism stuff because it didn't exist. Nothing that I could find. When he sits down with Claire to talk about this, it's on a bench under a black gum tree.
Oh.
There was nothing I could find. So you're welcome. So
No. Thank you, Diana. There's no you're welcome, Ginger. No, thank you, Ginger. You would have said it if you'd found something. But the fact that you found nothing.
I may not have.
You would. Okay. The only reason you wouldn't have said something is if it was not interesting, which leads me to believe that perhaps what you found was not interesting.
So he says it's not about love, meaning, no, he's not in love with Lizzie yet, but he's not worried about that. He had talked to his mom and he liked her well enough. He was sure that once they got married, they would grow to like each other and respect. And his family already loved her. So he wasn't worried about marrying Lizzie without loving her at first. But he says that's all done now. I can't marry her not just because I was in love with Samas, but because he's like, there was someone, but that's done now. And Claire's like, well, why not go ahead with marrying Lizzie if it's over? Mm-hmm. And her name is Myra. And he says he was actually going to tell Myra that it was over between them and that he was getting married to Lizzie, but he couldn't because she was dead. So, in his most recent trip to Hillsborough, he was not boffing his hoe. There was no hoe. He literally didn't boff her then. He boffed her probably plenty of times before, which is how he got the sif. So,
the sif. Shame on you.
So, why not marry Lizzie? Like, brass tacks. Why not marry Lizzie? If she's dead, like, what's the problem at all now? And he says, well, Myra, my hoe, died of the French disease, the sif. And he thinks he might have it. So he has come to Claire to take a look at his nuts. Maybe not his nuts. His junk. To see if indeed or confirm that he's had it.
Right. So let's take that information and then rub it all into and roll it all together with what's coming in the next couple chapters. And his deciding that his Gonosifa Herpalades is too much to allow him to marry Lizzie, and what he actually said to his family became something completely derogatory, which then got turned. I'm telling you, Uta, him not saying anything and his, I guess then silence led to a cacophony of like that ran downhill with gravity.
So later, Claire has told Jamie, and Claire says, yes, I mean, I to truly get a true diagnosis, I'd have to confirm it with looking at his blood, but I haven't gotten the blood yet. But as far as the sores I saw, yes, I'm sure. She'd taken scrapings from sometimes I write things.
It's so awful.
I forget what I wrote. She'd taken scrapings from his dong sores and looked at them under a microscope. She thought there was a chance in curing him, but she had to first make sure it was the spirochetes. For that, as I said, she'd need his blood. So she does get some blood from him. He's cooperating at least for now. And so to try and help, not soothe him, but, you know, keep his mind off the blood and being pricked in the arm, and just try and keep him talking and somewhat relaxed, if you will. She asks him about Myra. Now, no one uses the word dated, but I did. I don't know what else you call it. Like they slept. It was supposedly a loving relationship, but of course she slept around because that was her job. But he was okay with it. At least, I mean, he, you know, didn't kill her over it. So they quote unquote dated for about 2 years. They slept with each other for about 2 years. He only then seems to realize that his not marrying Lizzie, his mother's plan, and the fact that he was one of her two dear sons, her dear Manfred, and that he had the SIF, only then when Claire is taking his blood does he begin to think that, oh, this might not go over so well. I forgot about my Uta. He freaks. And at the sound of the men, or some people, coming toward the surgery, he jumps out of the window and runs off.
As you do. Bye-bye, Manfred.
So who was coming up to the surgery? It was young Ian, who was carrying Lizzie, who was again suffering from her malarial shenanigans. Not shenanigans, you know what I mean.
She's just dramatic.
She's not dramatic.
Are you sure?
That's mean.
But think about it. What if she's just dramatic? She likes the boys. We know she likes the boys.
She collapsed in the dairy shed and was found or seen by the Beardsleys, and then Ian was bringing her into the surgery now. He carried her.
I shit you not. If I was super skinny, I'd collapse everywhere just to get carried from place to place. That sounds amazing.
So Claire directs Ian to get the salve for Lizzie and he hands it to her. And she opens it up and says, here.
Did she ask him to rub it in on her legs?
Yeah, on her feet. So okay. She says, try to start rubbing it in her feet. And then she has him close his eyes so she can undress him. And then she covers her with a hem. So she can undress her and covers her with a blanket or something before Ian opens his eyes again. And they start to work it, or Claire does, starts to rub it into her body everywhere. And of course the Beardsleys appear again. Claire had forgotten about Manfred's blood. So she goes to put blood on the slides before they begin to coagulate, and she makes smears of the blood and then stains them so she doesn't lose that opportunity. So she had not had the chance to tell Manfred that there's a very strong possibility she could actually cure him. And it was talk of the spirochetes now gets Ian's disbelief too. That's hysterical. And this one's for Summa. Quote, the only one who seemed to accept the notion wholeheartedly was Malva Christie. And in her case, I thought the acceptance was due simply to her faith in me. If I told her something, she believed me. Unquote.
Nah, I will accept no positive tidings of Malva Christie. I won't. And to be honest, having read the books, the last chapter in this spree that we're about to talk about today, I saw all of the red flags being like hoisted on all the flagpoles.
This is an arc that Summer loves.
No, I don't. And I feel like Jamie made it worse.
Oh, Jamie didn't help.
Whatever adolescent fantasies that Malva had and had created for herself, he just played right into all of them. And I'm only saying that because I have read the books. I know it's been a while, but I have read the books and I know what's coming. And I know that he is doing nothing but feeding the monster inside of Malva right now.
So Claire has no idea. I mean, really anyone, I think, if you ask them. Claire has no idea where Manfred could have gone. And Lizzie wakes up briefly.
He jumped out the door. I mean, the window. Where else is he going to go? Anywhere. Anywhere but here. That's all that matters. He's not there.
So Lizzie wakes up briefly, and then Ian takes her up to her bedroom.
Yeah, see? He's just getting carried everywhere. This sounds amazing. I really need to get on that diet. And now we're going to move right along to chapter 46, entitled In Which Things Gang Ugly, which I roughly translate to In Which Things Go Ugly.
Or go to pot, exactly. Manfred has taken off, as we said in the last chapter, and he hasn't come back. Ian had gone off to get him. He's like, I will go after him and return him. And he returns with the black eye and some scrapes on his face.
And he's like, I'm a trapper, but I'm not that guy.
He reports that he does find him, obviously. He reports that Manfred said he'd intended to hang himself. But while Lizzie was currently out of it, meaning like upstairs in her bed, like, you know, in her malarial fever, there were things to think about, meaning about Lizzie, about this whole situation. It could get out to the wider population that Lizzie and Manfred had anticipated their vows, you know, premarital incubus succubus stuff.
I mean, they weren't bundling.
Oh, that's well, that obviously it wouldn't be good for anybody, but that would be much worse for Lizzie than it, of course, would be for Manfred.
Always would be.
Yes. The Beardsleys, bless them, are portrayed as protective of Lizzie, here literally sharpening their knives at prepping to avenge her honor by attacking Manfred.
I mean, I feel like they should, because he's being a right right now by... I mean, here's the thing. He didn't need to call off anything. He could have quietly gotten his and junk taken care of and moved on with his life. But what he chose to do ruined his life, his family's life, Lizzie's family. It impacted the Frasers. It impacted like everybody on the Ridge in ways that no one foresaw, apparently.
Yes. And Claire, although it's not her fault, Claire's not to blame for Manfred's doings.
No, of course not.
Absolutely not. But she admits in the last chapter that she had not told him that there was a strong possibility she could cure him.
She didn't get a chance to. He jumped out the window.
I'm not blaming her, but I'm saying she could, if it were more central in her mind, she could have said it, but I'm not blaming her that for his actions. So Claire then realizes, oh my gosh, Manfred's gone. He's likely not going to come back. We have to tell the McGillivrays. That would never be fun.
Why should she have to tell the McGillivrays? Why is it
well,
her
it's
place?
It's we.
I know. But here's the thing. This is a problem with first person storytelling of any book. It is the idea that whoever is telling the story feels like they personally have a stake in whatever it is to tell someone else something. And it was never her story to tell. All she had to do was be like, I don't know, he came here, but he left before I could do anything to help him. At no point was she ever the person who needed to talk to the McGillivrays, ever. That's a choice that she made for herself that she didn't have to do. Like, she put that on herself.
She did not put it on herself. She says we. So she puts it on herself and Jamie.
Because the point is it's neither her nor Jamie's business. Lizzie is not their child. Manfred is not their child. They are just bystanders on the Ridge. They did not have to put their foot in any of the things. They could have 100% abstained and said nothing.
And it would have gotten out clearly that the last place he was seen was there at the Ridge with Claire. And there would have been maybe not the same stuff that happened, but there would have been other.
Clearly, things are about to gang ugly. There's a whole chapter title about it.
Jamie says that he'll go tell Robin McGillivray. And so he does. And he comes back a little later and he says he'd only told Robin. He hadn't had the nerve to tell Uta. I mean, I don't blame him.
So Jamie.
Yes, Jamie did it.
Became a little bit of a puss.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not going to call him that. I wouldn't want to cross Uta.
Well, it's not about crossing Uta, but if you're going over there to let the McGillivrys know, you need to tell Uta because she is the McGillivry. Let's be honest.
She's married.
She's married to a McGillivry, but she is the McGillivry. She really is.
She runs the pants and the whole roost.
Yeah.
Yes. But eventually she is told. So in the middle of the night, Uta, how do we know Uta was told? Because she shows up in the middle of the night, or actually
she
just before dawn,
say about it.
Pounding on the door. Yes, she's got something to say.
And of course, it could not be her precious baby's fault. Clearly, it's not a McGillivray issue.
So Jamie and Claire are like, the who? The what? The fa? And they're like, not scared, but probably surprised, but shocked out of sleep. They get up. They're like, think of them like in a tangle of bed sheets and trying to get dressed to a certain amount. Jamie grabs a pistol. Claire looks out the window and she sees Robin. So it was Robin and Uta. Uta, they make their way in and she makes her way up the stairs to the bedchamber and yells at Claire, "How dare you insult my family by spreading such lies about my son?" And they tangle. Now, Claire, as anyone would react to this, you know, being woken up on a dime, not knowing what's going on, and someone come yelling at you and, you know, going to attack you, of course you're going to go a little berserk or at least defend yourself, you know, unless you freeze and you can't. Those are all like, it's the freeze, flight, fight or flight or freeze, and there's also fawn. Anyway, so her reaction, she is triggered, understandably, by a shrieking Uta, and she is triggered, and that switch goes off, and she is jerked back straight into her PTSD, into her abduction scenario. Quote, "I jerked back and screamed with all my strength, my nerves recalling for one dreadful instant, a hand striking at my face, hands pulling at me." Unquote. And she strikes Uta, shrieking, and she's gone wild. And she was unable to control herself as she does. Her rational mind is even thinking, like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? And Jamie finally stops her. And at this point, she's struck Uta. Uta looks at Claire as if, literally, not sarcastically, as if she's a crazy person, which she says she was. Uta admits that she believes Claire is crazy. And Claire cannot hear what Uta is saying. She can't. I don't know if she's so far in her dissociative state that she can't understand the English, but or she doesn't hear the words. But she is in an alternative place, even though she can kind of see herself what's happening. And then she snaps back into real time. And Uta's response, quote, "You are mad. I see. Well, then." Smartly, Uta knows you can't, and here I'm being a little facetious, yes. Smartly, Uta knows you cannot reason with the mad person. So she shuns them all. Salem, she says, and all businesses they do there will be closed. Moravia, right, will be closed to them. That's what she decrees.
All because her son likes whores. This is the outcome of whores, y'all. You don't have to do it. Not if you're going to shun an entire family. And that's the other thing. I don't know. Like, the McGillivrys cause a bunch of their own drama, but then suck everyone else into it. I don't know. I'm upset. I feel like I'm not part of this. I feel like
it's fiction.
I feel like my Jamie and my Claire are being punished for things completely outside of their own control. For things, like, what are they supposed to do?
Have you read the book?
I have read the book.
Have you read books 7 and 8?
I've read all the books. It's been a while. But my point is what? There's no way for them to have succeeded in this chapter. There's nothing they could have done, even if they did all the things right. And I'm not saying that they did anything wrong. I mean, they did as much as they could in the time given them before Manfred jumped out a window and ran into the woods. I mean, what else could they have done? Nothing. There was no way to please Uta. And that's what I'm saying. If they just shut up and said nothing, because if they had said nothing to Uta and Uta had come down later and been like, "What did Manfred say to you?" You were the last person that you saw that was seen with him. All you have to say is,
He took off.
He said he wanted to talk about a medical condition, and then he left unexpectedly, and I never got to hear what he had to say. But their innate need to be in the middle of all the fucking drama is to the point that it is to their detriment. They have just been told that their money is no good anywhere nearby their house anymore because of this bitch.
So Claire wonders if Jamie had also stepped out for a bit. And then as they chat, this is during, or I should say after the shutting, after they leave. And then as they chat, Lizzie appears at the door. Ian says shortly or curtly, because Lizzie's asking about Manfred. And Ian says curtly, he's poxed and gone. Well then. And he says also in a very snidey, not so nice tone, I hope you didn't give me your maidenhead. And then he says, I hope you didn't give him your maidenhead. He's kind of a dick to her.
You totally give Ian a dumb voice. I hope you didn't give him your maidenhead. That's what I heard.
You added a Scottish accent. I did not. Uta was not able to do all the damage she'd intended, but she was able to do enough.
Uta.
Lizzie's reputation did suffer, though. But what Lizzie felt was the loss of the large extended family she would have gained with marrying into the McGillivrays. Wow, Summer's all kinds of snorty today. Why is that funny?
It's funny because I know where her story goes.
Oh, you stop.
She's like, I'm gonna interrupt this German family.
So I'm gonna make my own. So another fatality, Uta did also, it wasn't just that Lizzie lost that family, the future family. Uta also made it so that the Familie Berisch, who was, I think was a pastor, whose sister or female relative was named Monica, who was sweet on Lizzie's father, whom Lizzie's father was sweet on, they kept them apart so they could not visit.
Good God. She like raised the earth, like scorched the earth.
Yes.
She's like, not just you, but you and you and you and everyone you ever have ever thought kindly about are all going to be crapped on now. I am ruining all of your lives because my son's a whore.
Exactly. And in the end, there's still no sign of Manfred.
He's going to go die of the pox somewhere.
Okay. So this is where it gets back into Summer's Lane. So what's one bright spot after all the Uta destruction? Ooh, should we call it the Uta destruction or Uta destruction?
No.
It doesn't really matter
what I think you should call it, because we both know that you're not going to listen to me. We both know
sometimes
that we're going to make.
Do. If it's
no, no, no.
If it's
what happens is we're going to make about 5 suggestions right now, and then you're going to say, "Oh, that's funny," or "That's clever. Let's go with that." And then you're going to go and edit this later and be like, "I came up with a completely separate thing," and I'm going to be like, "What? Where did that come from? I don't know. I just thought of it."
Sometimes.
So
yes.
Do not. You don't even need to include me in this part of the conversation because we both know. We both know that you're not listening to me.
So back to a bright spot. Amidst all of this destruction by Uta, there's still, amazingly, Thomas Christie. Thomas Christie had allowed, and again, this is from Claire's point of view. Deja vu. God.
Point of Uta.
No, POU is gone. So a bright spot, Thomas Christie. He continued to allow.
How is he a bright spot? Jesus Christ. This book.
He'd allowed Malva to continue to come to the surgery. As I said, this is from Claire's point of view. So that is a bright spot for Claire. But Thomas Christie did say that she cannot be part of any more ether play unless you give me warning beforehand. So he's not even cutting out ether play. He's just saying, tell me first. He's relaxed a tiny bit.
Which is only funny because he was personally not interested in ether play himself. Does that not sound like pig Latin to you? I can't.
No,
we need
sexual.
To find better terms. It sounds 100% like pig Latin. Pleather. And pleather's not a word, which is why it's weirder.
Enjoy restaurant quality meals for less in the comfort of your home. HelloFresh's gourmet recipes like balsamic fig sirloin are over 72% cheaper than an average restaurant meal. This is according to Zagat's dining survey. Our Easy Eats offering has tons of quick and easy meal solutions like oven-ready and 10 to 20-minute meals, perfect for your busy schedule.
More extras than ever before. HelloFresh's selection of delicious add-ons is getting bigger and better every week, featuring quick breakfasts and lunches, proteins, savory sides, and crave-worthy desserts. Eating healthier has never been easier with low-cal, carb-smart, vegetarian, and pescatarian options every week. And no matter what you choose, every single recipe is packed with fresh produce sourced directly from farmers.
Now more than ever, HelloFresh is committed to making sure that fresh, delicious food is available. As part of this mission, they've taken extra steps to keep their employees and customers safe, including no-contact delivery, tamper-proof packaging, and team member wellness checks.
With HelloFresh, there are actual oven-ready options available, wherein they literally send you the items and you just put them in the oven and cook it. And within, what does this one say? This is what I'm doing this week. I haven't made it yet. 20, 28 minutes in the oven and it's done. And there's your dinner. This is oven-ready cheesy salsa verde chicken. I'm a fan of that. I like having that option because most meal plans, they just send you the things. But there are days when if I wanted to cook, I would have cooked, right? And this time, I can just throw it in the oven because it's already ready and I'm excited about it.
So one of the things I like to do is I actually didn't get any recipes that were that quick to make. I mean, they were, as Summer said, they're already arranged. You don't have to like do any extra shopping or anything. You just have to take it out and maybe do minimal prep, but there was some prep. But one of the things that, because I don't do that a lot, as a matter of fact, usually if I do that kind of prep, it's through one of these, it's through a box like HelloFresh. But one of my favorite meals that I got in the box was Middle Eastern chickpea bowls with pistachio rice and garlicky white sauce. And man, that, well, I think my white, my, not my sauce.
Tell
I think the garlicky
sauce
was my favorite part of the entire dish. But anyway, it was, it was tasty. It was delicious. But as I said before, one of my favorite things is since we're now working from home, I don't get as much of a chance built into my day every day to listen to podcasts or audiobooks or what have you. So that's one of the things that I actually enjoy about a meal box like this is that with the prep that there is, I can throw on, I can do music, but usually, you know, music I don't have to necessarily attend to, right? But if I have a book or a podcast, I can listen and still do the work. And it just, you know, it keeps me busy, but I can also like process the information. And I enjoy that because I don't get a lot of time to do that.
And this is extra personal experience that nobody asked for. But if you go into the app, there is an app for HelloFresh. So when you sign up for them, you can download the app and they have an option where you can click what's called Cook It and they will talk you through. Like even if you don't have the cards ready, like if you're more, if paper cards don't really hold your fancy, you can go into the app and get all of the steps for that meal, which is kind of cool because then you can always go back in time and not keep the cards. Because while the recipe cards are great, I don't really have space in my life to have a binder full of all of the recipe cards that I've purchased from HelloFresh. Because let's be honest, I signed up for like the long haul with HelloFresh because I'm tired of figuring out what to make for dinner. I'm tired. I've been cooking everything for a year and I'm tired.
So go to HelloFresh.com/Outlander12 and use code Outlander12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping.
That's right. Use code Outlander12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. Go to HelloFresh.com/Outlander12.
America's number one meal kit. Claire shows Malva the wee spirals that she's found. So she does confirm that indeed Manfred had the spirochete. Claire explains about, or further widely, more widely explains about the bugs, the micronutrients, not micronutrients, the microorganisms. And there are good bugs and bad bugs and indifferent bugs. And she talks about how some traveled. And so Claire has to have, quote unquote, has to have a birds and the bees chat with Malva. Like she really doesn't, but Diana wanted her to, so she did. Then Malva figures out, she realizes what a hoe does. Oh, they do that for money. And then she asks Claire, how much money? This entire conversation is, I mean, admittedly pretty awesome. But hoeing and sticking their things and statues that look like women. So not able to leave the topic alone.
I am not here trying to shit on sex workers. There's clearly a call for them in the society and we need to treat them better because they're doing things that a lot of us don't want to do. So there is obviously a place in time and in society for sex workers, even though we shit on them and call them terrible things. Like, I don't have a problem with McGillivray's dead whore. I don't have a problem with her. She was doing her thing. I have a problem with him blowing everything up because of it. And, you know, I have a problem with the puritanical feelings that portions of this book are evoking. But I don't think we should shit on sex workers.
I don't think you are.
I'm just saying I want to make sure that we're clear that I am not pooping on sex workers.
So, unable to leave the topic, Claire ends the chapter. Diana ends the chapter by having Claire say this, by letting Malva know that indeed, besides having the bebes, because she tells her about that too, some women actually also do it for pleasure.
Oh, see, now Claire's just getting herself in trouble. Everything can always be traced back to Claire running her mouth, I believe. If you go back deep enough into the story, you can find a time wherein some terrible catastrophe that has befallen the Ridge, or her and Jamie, or just her, or just Jamie, goes back to something she has been unable to contain within her body that she just has to let out and say anyway. Chaos Monster. And that was chapter 46, moving right along to chapter 47, entitled Bees and Switches.
Claire again. One of her beehives has swarmed, so she's gone around trying to find them. She loses track of where she is, and guess where she pops up? Overlooking the Christie property. Of course. She sees that Thomas Christie is having his daughter kneel over a stump after cutting her own switches, which he will use to hit her, whip her, spank her, whatever you want to call it, and she pulls her dress up so he can beat her bare butt. He does. Throws him down, and once he's finished, Malva gets up.
I feel like that says a lot more about Christie than it says about Malva.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Like, why was that even necessary?
To whip her?
On her bare butt.
Oh, well.
With a switch she has to pick.
He didn't really wear underwear.
I mean, I'm sure it's because I want to make sure that you feel every inch of this stick I'm going to beat you with and don't have padding in the way of all of your skirts and dresses. But at the same time, that feels real sexual in nature.
Well, and also doing it outside. Like, even though I understand there are lots of land and lots of yards or miles, or maybe not miles, but maybe miles between properties or between homes, it's the doing it outside where someone could happen upon you, which happens in this chapter, that, that's just the odd part to me. Not the fact that it happens. Not even necessarily the fact that he has her go get the stuff. That's a special kind of torture. Like, he doesn't keep a stick around. He has her go find stuff so that he can do it. So the whole time she's gathering them, any child in this situation, not just Malva.
That's just mental. That's a mental thing.
I know
thing.
It's mental, but that's also and abuse. That is,
no, you're not wrong, but that is like not an uncommon.
Yes, it increases
pastime.
The anticipation, and the anticipation is often worse than the actual punishment in these situations.
Oh, yeah. And if you pick the wrong size stick, like if you pick a stick that pleases the beater, then they'll just beat you with that stick. But if you pick a stick that's too small, they'll go and pick a bigger stick. So, and then you'll get more beatings because you picked the wrong stick. Like there's a bunch of mental trauma associated with this type of punishment, I think.
So after he's done, he throws down the switches and she pulls her dress down. I think he goes back inside. But she gets up, pulls her dress down, and she goes walking off. And Claire sees that she's not weepy or scared or hurt, you know, emotion, at least not outwardly apparently so. And so this makes Claire think, huh, this means she's used to it. This is not anything new for Malva. So Malva ends up walking toward her and passes her by, but she doesn't see Claire. But Claire sees when she gets closer that she seems upset, not sad and not hurt, but angry. And when she was gone, Claire ends up going back home and she completely forgets anything to do with bees. She's like, doesn't matter.
And I'd have been angry too.
Yes.
If somebody made me go find the stick of my punishment.
Well, once she's home, Jamie finishes a conversation with Hiram Crombie and they chat. She tells him what she'd seen. And Jamie's all, that's his affair. That's Tom's affair. And Claire is afraid it might go further than a thrashing on the butt, but she has no evidence to support this. And this is another slash the same sticking point between Claire and Jamie and their two times. She will never understand the way people punish their kids or women in general. She understands it, like, on a logical level as far as, like, this is what's done. She can never come to terms with it. She says to Jamie, as she said before, it's different in her own time. Yes, there are bad people who would beat their wives and their children, truly beat them, but they would be considered criminals. And Jamie is trying to make her see there's a difference between smashing someone's face in and using some twigs to beat their butt. She can recognize the difference, but she is trying... I don't think they're speaking two different languages, although they might be because of their time frames. But I still to this day don't know that Claire has truly grasped why things are done that way. I'm not saying it's better, but why, you know, at the basis of it. But I also don't think, and understandably so, even understandably more so than Claire, because Claire's in his time. He's not in hers. He's never been there. He never will go. So Jamie, but I think she has a better grasp of his time than he has of her time. Not that she sits well with it, but she, at least I think because she's experiencing it, she can grasp it to some extent. And he just cannot grasp hers. And she remembers instantly the one time he had beaten her with his belt. And then he does. And so there's a conversation about that. And there's some strong feelings and some laughter, you know, kind of uncomfortable laughter, at least on Jamie's part. Well, he's not uncomfortable. He's like remembering it, you know, kind of, if not gleefully, he's remembering it. He had a good time. But she says, what about Bree? How would you feel if it was Roger and Bree? And he's like, I'd like to see Roger try. And then Jamie mentions Jenny. He mentions times after Culloden. And there was the time when, you know, when he was staying in that cave, he would come down to the house and he could tell something was up. The kids were gone. They had gone into town or something for the evening or for the day. And it was just Ian and Jenny. And he heard some ruckus upstairs. And he could tell that things were being knocked over. Things were, you know, they were being shoved or running around. And he could tell kind of what was going on. And then when they got to the part where they were making up, he's like, then I had to leave. So he would go stay with Granny. He stayed at least this one time with Granny McNabb because it was either that or stick around listening to his sister and his best friend and abuse himself. But he couldn't do that because it was his sister. So that's kind of
y'all.
Exactly. Yeah. So then, since he's at Granny McNabb's, he just tells her all about it. And she laughs. And she says, it's because of Ian's leg. It's to make him feel like he was doing more. Not that, because Ian knows his limitations. Those do not need to be pointed out to him. But it was something that Jenny liked to do. He didn't need it, but Jenny wanted to do it. She was able to make clear to him that she still thought him a man. And I thought that was, what did you think about that?
I mean, I feel like there are other ways to make someone feel like a man other than
well, that's part of the makeup session.
But other than picking arguments and rough sex, because that's how that whole chapter felt to me. Especially picking arguments and then rough sex while you have somebody else in the house. But I guess that was completely common for the time because why would you? I don't know. We are in a society now where we do not share our houses with our adult siblings and or our parents anymore. So the idea of having an adult sibling in the house and choosing to have loud, angry sex with your partner with them in the house
feels humidifying.
It feels like a choice, man. It feels like a real choice. And that's some big dick energy that I did not anticipate Jenny having.
Well, so the larger conversation, perhaps, is that Claire can understand and get behind is, quote, there were lines between him and me. there were certain lines, lines that were drawn by themselves, lines that were drawn by their culture, lines that were drawn maybe by their race. You know, if you're talking about the enslaved person versus the white plantation owner, master. So yes, I know they're not slave owners. I'm just saying there's all kinds of, I guess now you'd call it something along the lines of the intersections, right? There were all kinds of lines and thus all kinds of worlds, different cultures that people are parts of at the same time. And though they did cross these lines from time to time, they mostly observed them. It was funny though that Jamie's, I don't know how much better this makes it. Jamie tells Claire that, you know, Lyra made him mad plenty of times, but he never thought to thrash her. And he thinks, you know what? That's funny. I think it was because I didn't care enough for her. Meaning, I didn't care enough.
I didn't care enough to beat her.
Exactly. I didn't care enough to own her, to push my authority, press my authority over her. He didn't want to possess her like he wanted to possess Claire. That's a whole other show.
Possession, yeah, I was going to say, that just...
That doesn't make it better. Doesn't make it sound better anyway.
You know, I know everything is dependent upon the scope in which you view something through, or the lens in which you view things through. But when you view them through your voice telling me these things, I'm becoming concerned with Jamie. Because he only beats the ones he cares for.
Oh, that's all bad.
Right? That's what I'm saying. That's my summation of everything you just said right now. And I just can't get behind it. And him saying, maybe if I'd only liked her more. If I'd liked her more, maybe. Maybe I would have beat her and then she would have, you know, been a better wife if I'd cared enough to beat
her. I'm glad, not just that they separated, obviously, but I'm glad he didn't beat her, obviously, because that's not right. But I'm glad, especially
not
for her
own sake.
Not
that she didn't deserve it.
Well,
she's a horrible person.
I still don't think she deserves to be beaten. But for her, because we see a lot. We don't learn much in the show. So if you've never watched the show, it doesn't exist yet.
We're not that but far if ahead, we can you? Rationalize.
No, I mean, we haven't seen season six. But up until, forget season six. Up until now, what has been shown, right? What has been shown in the TV show, the adaptation. We got a little bit more than we bargained for in season four, fair enough. But we have not been shown a lot, and not that the book gives us a lot, don't get me wrong, but the book has the space for this, so it makes sense we would get it. But Diana has done, you may not like her or appreciate her, and that's fine, but Diana has done, I think, a decent job of showing us a little bit more behind the curtains of Lyra, meaning we don't ever have to like her. You don't have to like her. You don't have to love her. You don't have to respect her because she did really bad things when she was quite young, right? And then bad things when she was in her 30s, when she shot Jamie, all of that. The thing is, though, I'm glad that out of everyone, not that him beating Claire was good or right or excusable, but I'm glad that he didn't end up beating Lyra because she has been, and this is what I'm saying, is we don't know her whole story. No, we don't need that side. We don't need that series. But we don't know her story of what she went through in her two marriages. Very likely she was abused. She had high hopes for, I mean, I don't know how high, definitely high hopes at 16, but she had probably some hopes for being with Jamie in her 30s, right? When they got married after Claude and all that, at least to have a partner. And she probably still had, you know, some of her earlier crush or whatever, obsession, whatever, with him. I don't know how much was left. But for some reason,
I think at that point, it was 100% possession for her. It was that he...
Oh, fair enough. Okay.
It was the idea that he was hers. And if she can't have him, nobody gets to have him. Whatever you want to call it. Point being, I'm not saying she deserved to be beaten. I'm just saying we've spent the last 20 years making it as okay as we can that Jamie beat Claire. We've spent 20 years doing that.
Okay.
No, I know.
But yeah, people have defended it.
Okay.
Yes.
But it's and it's not even defending it. It's trying to view,
rationalized it,
everything through the lens of historical time period. So given all of those things, it still makes it incredibly difficult sometimes when you're dealing with, you know, chapters with people who are just of that time. So when we get Claire in a chapter like that, we get a bit of a view into seeing that type of society through the eyes of somebody from a more current time period. Whereas when it's not from her view, it's just, oh, well, look away. They're beating their kids.
Yeah.
So I don't know. There's a lot. Obviously, there is. There's a lot.
And in the end of the chapter, well, what I was trying to wind down. We get a little bit in the books, not much in the show, of how she is not just, yes, she did a bad things, but she has suffered over the last 20 years. We don't get a lot of detail. She is also, she is vindictive and all of this stuff, and that's bad. And she needs to not do that, right? That needs to stop. That is not excusable. What I'm saying is, whether or not, and actually it's funny that I'm saying this. What I was trying to say was, I'm glad Jamie never beat her for whatever reason. I'm glad he never beat her or tried to quote unquote own her because of what she had been through previously in her marriages, supposedly maybe. But you know what? Even that is actually not really a good thing to say, because even if she hadn't been abused in any marriage, and which we don't have 100% proof for, but there's allusion to it, right? Mm. Because there are scenes with that Marsley talks about with her face being smashed into the guy, one of her, either her dad or the first husband, must have been the second guy, because those are his kids, McKimmy. Anyway, he was violent with them. Remember when there was the scene or the talk about how the milk was spilt?
Well, yeah, there was violence, but also she was never, when she was married to Jamie, they never had a marriage bed.
Well, he tried, and he could. And she would only shrink from him, and she would cry. Like he would. She would never say what was wrong. And I don't know that the readers ever know exactly. I mean, maybe Diana hasn't
something,
told us exactly what was
something
wrong.
Something traumatic clearly happened, and they were people and products of their time.
I agree. So what I'm trying to say is, whether or not she had two or one or ever any abuse in any marriage before coming into Jamie's bed or into Jamie's life again, it doesn't matter if she was abused. Yes, it matters if she was abused, but it doesn't matter whether she was abused or not as far as does she deserve not to be beaten. No, no one deserves to be beaten. So I just took the wind out of that sail. I'm glad I caught that. Anyhoozle, the chapter ends with Jamie and Claire talking a lot about Alotta, but they agree that they own each other. So, I mean, it's the romanticization, sexification of owning another person. I know it's metaphorical, but I don't know.
I'm not happy with that term. So I'd like to strike it from the record that we did not just spend time talking about people owning other people. I hate it. I don't like it. Finishing up this week's read along with chapter 48 entitled Wood Ears, which I believe are mushrooms.
Yes, ma'am.
Perfect.
So Jamie promises to have a chat with Malva later, and he's out and about walking around, and he comes across this, huh?
I said, oot in a boot.
Yes. He comes across a snake and uses a stick to move it off the path, but it went into a bush or some area. On the other side of that bush or some area where the snake had gone was Malva. So he didn't know he was there, and she's out collecting mushrooms, and she shrieks, and she hates snakes. And he's like, ooh, and he helps her up or whatever and says, oh, no, you don't have to do that. And he gets the snake away from her. And she says she hates snakes. And she tells of a man who once brought a king snake into meeting, so to church, and how the snake bit Mr. Crombie on the lip.
Were they Pentecostal? These people in the meeting?
I don't know.
And also, maybe. I feel like Diana has spent way too much time with snakes. I'm not saying snakes aren't a problem in the wilderness and that you don't come across them, but they have had them in the outhouse. They had him attacked by a snake where he almost died, and now there's another snake.
Book two?
Like, in like every book, there's a snake, right?
Except maybe it feels book like one.
It. It feels like the big bad of all these books is snakes.
So Hiram wouldn't come to Claire for treatment after he'd been bitten on the lip by a snake, although, albeit a non-venomous. But he wouldn't come to Claire for treatment because he didn't want his nose lopped off by mistake. And what? And Malva's like, you know, some people think Claire's a witch. And he clarifies, quote, she's a Sassenach. Folk will always say such things. Folk will always say such things of a stranger, especially a woman, unquote. But Malva doesn't think so. She wants to be just like her.
Why do any of us care about Malva? I don't care what she wants to be just like. I feel like all I can see is the recipe for disaster that is already in play right now.
So what about Thomas Christie, or sorry, her dad, allowing Malva to spend time with Claire? She says, well, he doesn't say I can't go.
Mm-hmm. This I blame Claire for, because she's like, keep secrets from your daddy. Don't tell your daddy. Like, that just starts a whole secret keeping. That's what I'm saying. It starts a whole like secret keeping society between them, which makes what they're doing together feel wrong and secretive, but exciting. So they've created this shared mystery between them that is purely with Malva and the Frasers. So I feel like, I mean, you hate to say that everything is Claire's fault, but it's Claire's fault. I feel like the chaos monster completely guided this whole thing into fruition.
Malva says that she has no plans to go wed anyone anytime soon. And that's in response to Jamie saying, oh, well, you know, now that, you know, you're getting older and, you know, what does your dad think about, you know, your, you know, what's going to happen when you, because she does all this work for them, right? She keeps house. What's going to happen when you get married and go away? And she's like, I don't have any plans to go marry anyone anytime soon. Now, she doesn't want Jamie to say anything about suitors to her father. And, quote, that rang a small alarm bell in him, unquote. He tells her where some more wood ears are. And he's like, oh, come on, I'll show you. Then he brings up Alan, her brother. Now, we get a lot more of, I think more than we've known up till this point, obviously, more about the Christie's backstory, right? She and Alan, Malva and Alan, both grew up in Edinburgh. So Thomas had married in the colonies, but this wife had gone back to Scotland. Malva asks if it's true that Jamie's grandsire was Lord Lovett. And he says yes. And, quote, she laughed at that and very prettily urged him to tell her more of his sordid family history, unquote. So here we can see the beginnings of why Malva is Summer's favorite character.
No. And if you're going to say prettily as the descriptor for how she does something, they are trying to set it up like that, too.
That was Diana. Which completely. Absolutely.
For sure. But what I'm saying is they are setting her up to be the thing she ends up being, and he is not.
He's not helping.
He's not helping. He's not helping at all. And he should have recognized, because she was prettily asking him things, he should have recognized the look of a young girl looking to pin shit on somebody else. You know what I mean?
Well,
he should have recognized
the
look
of
a schemer.
Now, the word is there. You cannot defend it. I'm not defending it. The word is there, and I read it as it's written. However, the end of that quote, which I did not include, was she very prettily urged him to tell her more about his sordid family history, .. And he could tell this, or he thought this, because she was trying to veer off questions or discussion about her family. So she wasn't just suddenly latching onto Jamie and saying...
So you're saying she was manipulative and manipulating the conversation? So this is something else we should pay attention to with Malva?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So we learn more, and this is what we're going to have to talk about a little bit, because even after I took notes chronologically as things happen in the chapter, and even reading it made me go, huh? But here's a little bit, we'll talk about this in a second. So we learn more of Tom's backstory. He'd been arrested 2 or 3 days after Culloden and imprisoned for the next 10 years or so, like Jamie, before being transported to America.
And he was imprisoned for literally just being Scottish. Like, he was not part of the Culloden band, he was just Scottish. And so if anyone has a right to have a chip on his shoulder, because he's like, I didn't any of the things, but I'm still suffering the fate of somebody who did all the things, which makes me think that he should have just been like, fine, then I guess I'm going to do all the things. But that's not what he did, because, you know, he's
actually
religious
a man.
Yeah. He's a religious man who has a daughter.
Jamie didn't know Malva's exact age, but he thought, oh, she's 18 or so. So she must have been conceived right after the Christies' arrival in the colonies. So Jamie thinks that Tom was arrested, imprisoned, came to the colonies, married someone, conceived a daughter almost immediately. The problem with that, though, is that she was raised in Edinburgh. So after he got
imprisoned for the people in the back.
Imprisoned for 10 years, gets shipped off to the colonies, gets married, you know, pretty quickly, conceives a daughter pretty quickly, and then we don't know where she's probably born in the States or the States, the colonies, who knows. But at some point, she or they all go back to Edinburgh, because in this same chapter, we learned that she and Alan both were both raised in Edinburgh. So there's a trip. So they went back. So he came here, came to the colonies, was forced to go to the colonies,
right,
met
he was
a person.
Transported.
Yeah, that's why he was forced. He was transported. He was.
Which is why it's weird that people who are transported can magically go back, which means his wife couldn't have been transported, because if you're transported, you're not allowed to leave, right? That's the whole point. That's your new prison.
I don't know. I don't know that they have. I don't know that they have rules. The thing is, they're transported, so their quote unquote their fees are paid for, right? Because they're being forced to do. They're not going to be forced to pay that off. Although maybe not him, but some may have been forced to become indentured servants to pay for that transportation. I believe that happened as well. So we don't know what happened for Tom. However, if Tom came to the colonies, met someone, got married, had a baby, wherever that baby was born, then he had to go back. But see, this is where it doesn't make sense to me. And dear listener, because here's the thing. It couldn't have been after Culloden, but it couldn't have been before prison, because she would have had to have been born before he went to prison, because prison was only about 7 to 10 years ago. She's 18 years old. So yeah, it's falling apart for me. So what do you think happened?
I don't know. There was a lot of math that I wasn't prepared to do. And I'm still not 100% prepared to do the math. But so, if that's the math, but he's been out for longer than that, hasn't he? He has been physically out. How old is Willie right now?
I don't know. But to me, the best time marker is when Claire comes back. She comes back at 20 years.
So 20 plus?
Maybe 5.
Plus
5 or 6?
5. Okay. So if
A few chapters ago. A few chapters ago, we had a date. It's June 1774. So we're in 1774. Claire went back in 68, which would have taken her to 1765.
No. She went back in the 40s.
No.
And she was there through the 60s. She left in the 40s, came back in the 40s, and Bree was born and came back in
I'm
the
talking 60s. About the 20th century. When did she go back to the 18th century for the second time? 68.
In the 60s.
That's what I said.
That's 68. Not what you said.
I said she went back in 68.
No, but what I heard was went back. To me, that was went back to the future.
No, she went back to see Jamie and hopefully find him and live with him in 68. It's 203 years back. So that's 1765. If it is now, well, that's a little more time. Maybe this is better then. Okay, so 1765, right now at 1774 minus 1765. Is 9. So a little bit older than Willie, I think, or younger. I don't know.
Which makes sense, because if she should be younger than Willie, because if he got transported from
Auschwitz summer.
So terrible. If That's he got transported, good God. If she got transported, he got transported from Ardsmuir to the colonies and was there about the time that Willie was born. It would have given him time to meet a lady and get married and have a kid here. And then the lady he met here going, I hate this place. I'm going back to Edinburgh and taking the kids and going and raising the kids. Now, I don't know what happened. Maybe the minute she died, she was like, back on a boat with you.
Here's the thing I think we can all take from this. Summer and I have read the books, one of us more than the other, and we still can't get this straight. And it doesn't really matter. I know we just talked about it as if it did. It truly does not matter, the dates and times and details, because you can tell it's confusing. I will say this. It's a small spoiler, but no details. There's a reason it's confusing, because the way things are told is not the way things are. So we need to stop. I agree with Summer. We need to stop trying to do math. Stop trying to make it work. You will never make it work. I promise you. And there's a reason it doesn't work.
And she's a monster.
Oh, no, the reason it doesn't work is not because of her. It is way not her fault. My point is, it's something
it's because
outside
Diana
of
had to be extra. Diana had to be
Diana?
Super extra.
100%.
In creating 100% this character.
So let's stop all the 20-minute math stuff. Oh, Lord. So, yeah. So the whole
The whole
exercise that Summer and I just, and I didn't intend for it to be that long, but the whole
you
thing
did.
Of us.
You paused yourself and waited for me to come back.
I did not. Only because I said it was her favorite character, not because of the stupid math. So Summer and I have just spent way too much time trying to use Diana's description and her age that we're just given and the year, like trying to make it work. And what that would entail is him being sent to the colonies after 10 years, finding someone, marrying them, having a kid, and then at some point that kid or the mom, whatever, going back to Edinburgh, like almost right away, because she and Alan were raised in Edinburgh. So in order to make all those things work, that is just wackadoodle. And then how did he find out that his kids are like, how did he end up getting his kids if they left, right? Did he go back with them? I don't know. It doesn't make sense. So yeah, the whole reason that that doesn't make sense is because it didn't happen. That's all I'm going to say. So we learn more of the backstory, but it's not really helpful at all. However, what we can say
it doesn't matter because Malva Christie's a liar.
Well, she's not lying here. She's telling
an
what she knows.
Encouraged to liar. She's been encouraged by Claire to lie. And when you start lying, everything gets easier.
Tom, and see, here's other stuff. So Tom had told Roger that his wife had died of influenza. So, but where had Alan come from? Who was his mother? So Malva says that she and Alan had the same mother. So Tom had been married before Culloden, and she traveled to the colonies with him and then had Malva, so the same woman, and then took off or died. And then what she doesn't say is that they ended up back in Edinburgh. So it's all kind of
the only two options.
What?
What if she taking off or dying? What if she just... What if there was a third option? I'm just saying, those aren't the only
two. She's kept in a closet somewhere?
Maybe. Or maybe she was like, I'm done, y'all. Back to the colonies with you. No, she doesn't have to take off. She sent them off.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So Malva says, so they talk about Scotland, and she says she's never actually seen the Highlands. And she says the mountains are lonely sometimes, but they're pretty. They stop and drink at a spring, and not in a sexual way, but he is appreciative that he admits or notes that she is pretty. So there's a description in there of how he is admiring her looks. It does not come across as skeevy, but the fact that he does it or that Diana tells us is a little bit skeevy. But Jamie's not macking on her. He's just realizing that like they're going to, like she's going to have her choice of suitors. That's what he's thinking. Now they talk of his past of hiding in the heather and some of the stuff he's had to do. And he shows her finally where to get those wood ears, the whole reason they're out here. And he leaves her there, quote, wondering about the woman who had loved and left Tom Christie, unquote.
I think she was the smartest person in this chapter and she wasn't even there. And that was chapter 48. Join us next time and we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with chapters 49, The Venom of the North Wind, and chapter 50 entitled Sharp Edges. And if you'd like to join us to continue the conversation, in the meantime, you can go to our group page at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And again, a very special thanks to this episode's co-producer, Linda B. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon and even how to become a co-producer, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you have a hankering to wear some of my artwork, either on your face or your shirt or, I don't know, whatever else they have for sale, you never know. Sometimes they're always coming up with new stuff every time I look on that site. You can go to our shop at www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
And again, if you have not joined our text community, we would love to have you. Text HELLO to 916-659-5112. Thank you so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod. That my young